City Talk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm.
This is Talk to Trisha on City Talk 105.9.
In 1971, when she was 17, Kelly Connor woke up to a day that was to change her life forever. Now, although she was born in Manchester, Kelly's family had emigrated to Australia, and on this particular April morning, she was driving to work on a quiet, clear road, and in a lapse of attention, Kelly knocked down and killed an elderly pedestrian. Now, although she was never charged, the accident profoundly affected her life, and it's taken nearly 40 years for her to begin to come to terms with what happened. In 2001, Kelly moved back to the UK, and she's written about her experience in a book called To Cause a Death. The book is an autobiography, but it's also an attempt to broach a subject that's very rarely discussed. When a tragic accident like this happens, most of the focus is directed towards the victim and their family. Now, this is despite the fact that a simple error of judgment separates any one of us listening from someone in Kelly's position. Well, Kelly joins us now on the phone. Kelly, first, welcome to City Talk.
Thank you, Tricia.
Can we start with that day back in April 1971? That was, as I said in the introduction, to change your life completely.
It did change my life utterly. It was, as you say, a beautiful... it was a Sunday morning. It was the Sunday after Easter. It was also my younger sister's 12th birthday. It was a day when we... as a family, we're intending to celebrate my sister's birthday with lunch together. I was working shift work as a telephone operator in what was the then called the post office, the equivalent today of what you would think of as BT.
Yeah.
And I was working on the Sunday morning, an 8 a.m. to midday shift, and my father... was going to drive me to work that morning. But when the morning came, he fancied a lie-in, told me to drive myself using his car. Now, I'd only had my license 3 months, but and in fact, I got my license on my 17th birthday.
Yes.
But on that very day, Dad had given me a spare key to his car, and he was incredibly generous in allowing me to drive his car whenever I wanted, whenever he wasn't using it. And, and so there was nothing unusual in this, in him saying, go on, take the car. And the plan was then that Mum, Dad, and my sister would catch the train in, meet me at work, and where obviously the car was, and then we'd all go out together for lunch to celebrate Jane's birthday.
Yes.
But when I was driving to work on a very clear, quiet road, say Sunday morning, almost no other traffic around, I was travelling on a part of the road that was a very steep hill.
Right.
And at the crossroad of the hill, on my right, there was a taxi that was waiting to pull out. Now... as it happened, the road rules had changed that weekend. Australia used to have this rule where cars entering from the right actually had right of way, and if you were travelling toward the car that was on the right waiting to pull out, you had to stop and let them out. But it changed that weekend.
Oh, gosh.
And so I was travelling. I saw this car on my right, this taxi, and I thought, oh, is he going to pull out in front of me? Because he would have had right previously. But so I was really fixated on what he was going to do. And because I was travelling up a steep hill, of course, I had my foot fairly flat on the accelerator to get up the hill. I was determined I wasn't going to get into a tangle with this taxi because in 3 weeks' time, I was heading off on a working holiday with some friends of mine, and I was looking forward to that. I was very excited about it. Anyway, the taxi didn't pull out. I passed him quite safely, but I was so fixated on him that even when I passed him safely, I was looking in my rear vision mirror at what he was doing. Still had my foot firmly on the accelerator because I just had this sense I wanted to get away from the taxi. It was completely irrational. There was no reason to have that feeling. But it wasn't until I saw him turn around, turn behind me that I then eased up on the accelerator, looked forward, and directly in front of me was a pedestrian crossing. I knew the pedestrian crossing was there. And when I looked forward, there was a woman who was three quarters of the way across the road on the crossing. When she had first stepped on the crossing, she wouldn't have even been able to see my car because I would have been below the crest of the hill.
But did she see you coming towards her?
I don't believe she did until I applied the brakes. And then, obviously, the squeal of the brakes caused her to look up. She started to run. But I was too close to her. I couldn't take evasive action. She couldn't outrun me, and the inevitable happened.
Did you feel her hit the car, or did you?
I'm sure I must have, but my memories of the impact are they're non-existent, basically. I remember hitting the brakes. I remember the sensation of applying the brakes. I don't remember the sound of the squeal of the brakes, but it was as though something happened to my senses in that moment. They just didn't work in the way that you would normally expect them to.
When did you sort of become aware of what had happened?
Well, it wasn't until the car had stopped. And, so there I was, stopped in the middle of the road. Literally, there'd been a second or two between seeing her and the impact and however many seconds it took for the car to stop. Yeah. And when I stopped, I couldn't see her. I couldn't hear her. I couldn't... and because it had literally been seconds, my first thought was, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
I just couldn't...
You couldn't believe.
I couldn't believe. I couldn't I couldn't accept that something so shocking could have happened. And it's awful to say, but I think I could have probably just started the car and driven away again if it wasn't for the fact that the taxi then pulled up in front of me. He stopped, he got out, he banged on the window. I was just in a state of shock, just holding on to the steering wheel. I don't think I even looked at him. But the fact that he stopped and got out, I then knew that it was real.
Oh, yes.
I knew that I had actually, she had been there and I had hit her. But he shouted through the window that he had a fare, he had to leave, but he'd called for an ambulance.
So and at that stage, did you think maybe she was okay?
I don't know what I thought. But he left, and then I knew that it was real, and this complete state of panic then just overtook me. My heart was thumping. My hands were shaking.
Did you get out of the car to see where
she was? I did. The strange thing is that while all these other panicked experiences are going on, there's another part of me that was very clear about what had to happen. I'd remembered that there was a blanket on the back seat of the car. I remembered you had to keep accident victims warm. I got out, I got the blanket, I went round to the side of the car, I covered her with the blanket. But there's still this other side of me that's screaming in protest. Don't go anywhere near her. Don't look at her. Don't.
Was she badly injured? Do you know? Or?
She was unconscious.
Right.
And she was lying face down, very close to the front of the car, the wheel of the car, tire of the car. I mean. And I did nothing, I have to say, other than put the blanket on her. I just couldn't.
You just froze.
I just froze.
So when did you find out that she'd actually died?
A couple of hours later, because I was taken to the police station. Obviously, mm-hmm. the ambulance came, the police came. She was she was taken to hospital. She was still alive at that stage.
Right.
I was taken straight to the police station where they took a statement. They took me home.
What did they say to you? Did they tell you were due for criminal prosecution or anything like that?
No, the police were extraordinary. It was two police officers, two male police officers. I just assumed I when they put me in because one I was put in the police van in the front of the police van, and the other police officer drove my dad's car to the police station, and I just assumed that I was going to be locked up. So they sat me down, they gave me a cup of tea, they started to take my statement, and when it got to the part of the statement where they asked what speed I was driving, I said, well, I hadn't actually looked at the speedometer, but because, my foot was heavily on the accelerator from climbing the hill, I knew that I was well over the speed limit and estimated I was probably travelling at about 45 miles an hour.
Which people don't think of as fast, do they?
Well, he then said to me, what's the speed limit? And I said, it's 35 miles an hour. And he said, so how fast are you travelling? And I said, well, I think around 45. And again he said, and what's the speed limit?
Oh, gosh.
So I said, well, 35. So how fast were you travelling? And I looked at the police officer that asked the question, I looked at the other one, and I didn't know what to do. So I took a gamble, and I said, 35 miles an hour. Good, he said, and that's what he wrote.
So they were trying to protect you?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now,
and the same thing happened when they asked me, was I certain that she was on the crosswalk?
Yeah.
And I said, well, I was too close to her. I couldn't be certain, but yes, I was certain. And they said, did you see her feet on the crosswalk? And I said, no, I didn't. So they said, well, then you can't be certain she's on the crosswalk. So they were very determined that that I shouldn't be charged.
That two lives shouldn't be destroyed.
Yes, and I mean, now I can understand and appreciate that, and I'm grateful for it.
Well, could
at
you
the
then?
Time, though, it did make things worse because I knew that I was guilty.
Okay. Let me just remind our listeners, I'm talking to Kelly Connor, who's talking about the time in April 1971 when she was just 17 years of age and accidentally knocked an elderly lady down. When they came and told you that she had passed away, how did you react to that, Kelly?
Oh, that was awful. We were actually at the hospital because when the police officers took me home, my mother's immediate response was she wanted to go to the hospital to find out how the woman was and whether she had any family, whether she needed any help. And so on. So that was what we did. We went straight to the hospital, and it was when we arrived, the first person we saw was one of the police officers who had taken the statement.
Right.
He took us into the waiting room, went off, came back, and told us that she had died.
Gosh.
And it was. It was as though I knew in that moment that that my life was never going to be the same, and something physically happened. It's as though you may not be old enough to remember the old movies where sometimes they used to play out of sync. and the sound was slightly out of sync with the vision. Mm. It's as though that happened, and I entered a different dimension of time and space. I was standing in front of my mother and the policeman, but it's as though I shifted a dimension.
Was it like is this real or am I dreaming? Am I really here?
No, it wasn't quite like that. I knew that I was there. I knew they were there, but suddenly I was literally in a different time and space dimension to what they were.
And but how did the rest of your family react? You know, because you said your mum was with you. What happened there?
Deep shock. My mother. Her only way of dealing with it was to, it was a protective measure, but it was destructive, because she said, "We will live our lives as though this had never happened."
Oh my gosh! We'll never talk about it.
Never talk about it. We will never acknowledge it. This will not be allowed to affect us. And I know that she meant that to be protective.
Yeah, but what did it do to you?
It left me in this state of being completely abandoned. Mm. I couldn't talk to anybody about it. I couldn't express the shame and the guilt and the fear.
What about your dad then?
My dad wasn't allowed to talk to me about it. My mother at one stage did come in the room and find us talking about it and was insistent that it must never, ever happen again. And, of course, because my dad had given me the keys to the car that morning, it had a tremendous impact on him as well. And
did he blame himself?
I imagine he must have. We never talked about it because my mother didn't allow us to, but 6 months after the accident, he just vanished.
What do you mean vanished?
He just vanished.
There was a row? He left?
Well, I wasn't living at home at that time because this holiday that I'd been planning to take 3 weeks, I was due to leave 3 weeks after the accident.
Right.
My mother insisted that I still go on that holiday, which meant I had to give an affidavit to the court before leaving and so on. And then the court decision, the coroner's decision, came while I was in fact away on this trip. And my parents separated while I was away.
And you didn't know?
Not until afterwards. No, my mother wrote me a letter and told me. And then it was a month or two after they had separated that my father just vanished.
When you say vanished, you didn't know where he was?
Vanished, no, we had no idea where he was.
Did you speak to him again?
No, never. And it was 10 years after he vanished that we were informed that he had died. That was because my mother had been named as in his will.
And where had he gone?
He'd gone to Adelaide.
Just run away or
seemingly. Yeah.
Oh, gosh. And what about your sisters and the rest of the family, your neighbours, people like that?
I never spoke to neighbours about it. Ironically, Margaret's brother, Margaret Healy, was the woman that died. Her brother lived in the same street.
Oh, gosh.
And
did he talk to you?
Sorry?
Did he come and talk to you?
He did. A couple of weeks after Margaret had died, I arrived home to find him talking to my parents. I don't know whether it had been prearranged or whether he just knocked on the door, but it was certainly a surprise to me.
Yeah.
And he was wonderfully kind and generous and considerate and said that he bore no grudge.
Did that make it harder, though?
It did. It did, because I knew then something of the character of the woman that I had killed.
Yeah.
You know, he told me that Margaret wouldn't hold a grudge, wouldn't want this to ruin my life.
Oh, gosh.
And again, it took decades before I could really embrace the generosity of what he was offering.
And during those decades, Kelly, and you talk about this in the book, the guilt and shame that you felt became so intense, you tried to take your own life.
Yes, because I had come to the realization that the only person I could really talk to about what had happened was Margaret. She was the person I needed to express my guilt to, my shame to. She was the person that I needed to ask an apology of. Mm-hmm. And the only way I could do that was to die.
Oh, did you try and visit her grave or anything? To talk to her?
No. It felt absolutely right that the only way to do that, to really talk to her, was to die. And it was a question that had consumed me right from the start, whether I had the right to continue living, having caused somebody's death. And it was after 2 years of asking that question that I finally found the answer. No, I didn't have the right. And of course, that then gave me the added, what seemed at the time, the added bonus that, that of course, that meant that we could meet.
But you were saved from that overdose.
Yes,
and
in fact,
you were angry.
I was very angry. I was devastated once I was brought back to consciousness. So devastated that I was then committed to a mental hospital because they, of course, remained concerned that I would attempt it again.
But didn't anybody sit down and talk to you about it?
No.
It was still not talked about. Nobody asked why you tried to do what you did or what had happened or go back to the past?
No. In fact, the psychiatrist that was treating me told me I was not allowed to talk about it.
Oh, no. Which made things even worse.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the ironic thing. Oh, ironic is a strange word to use. But everywhere I turned, I was not allowed to talk about it. I mean, even giving the police statement, I was not allowed to speak the truth. And it just happened over and over and over again. And the reason why I wrote the book is it apparently is still the case today. You won't find any academic research into this. You won't find any doctors or therapists who have written about it. There's no research. There's very few drivers who have written about it. There's such silence around it. It's quite extraordinary.
And when you think of all the thousands of accidents, there must be thousands and thousands of people suffering. Have people contacted you since you wrote the book and about what they're going through? What sort of things, Kelly?
Yes, many drivers have contacted me who, like me, have never spoken about it. Mm. Like me, who have longed to let the person who died know of their distress and their regret. I've been contacted by the families of many drivers who, like me, wanted to suicide and did. Many of them were successful in that. And it does seem that there may well be a second silent tragedy here of large numbers of drivers who have committed suicide after causing an accidental death.
Well, we're going to take a short break. I've been talking to Kelly Connor about that split-second mistake that changed her life forever. And we'll be talking to Kelly some more right after the break. So we'll see you then here on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool.
This is Talk to Tricia on City Talk 105.9.
Hi, I'm talking to Kelly Connor. We're talking about the split-second mistake that changed her life forever when she was just 17 years old in a decision that, as she's telling us, was haunted her whole life. She looked into her rearview mirror. Before she knew it, she'd mown down an old lady on a pedestrian crossing. Kelly, it took you 14 years to tell your own daughter about what happened, and that was after a marriage breakup. Mm. First of all, was the marriage breakup, do you put that down to that secret, that guilt?
Yes, I mean, it becomes very difficult to live your life authentically when you're carrying that kind of secret.
Yeah.
And
did you tell your husband?
Yes, he knew it had happened, but again, we didn't speak about it.
Oh.
And of course, there was a further complicating secret with the fact that I'd been committed to a psychiatric hospital.
Oh, yes.
You know, and I didn't tell him that. He did know, I say, he knew the basic details of the accident, but he didn't then know that, you know, that I'd been committed to a psychiatric hospital. So there was secret upon secret that then...
And shame and guilt.
Exactly. And in some ways, The shame of being in a mental hospital is great, as great if not greater than you know, than the original shame.
Yes, and sadly I can understand that. But how did your daughter react when you told her what?
Oh, she was amazing. I mean, Megan is a pretty amazing individual anyway. But you know, so she was 14 when I finally realised that I had to tell her or else there was possibly going to be damage. Well, there would have been damage to...
Damage to who?
To our relationship, to the relationship between Megan and I, you know, if this secret continued to live between us.
Did you treat... Was there something about the way you related to her then that threatened to cause damage?
No, I just realised that keeping this secret was preventing me from properly relating to people, and as Megan entered adolescence, and I think adolescents in particular are so sensitive to truth.
Yes, they are.
Yes. And I wanted to honour that. I wanted to be truthful with her about who I am.
And how did she react when you told her?
Well, she said, oh, yes, you know, I've always known that there was a secret. It makes sense now that there's always been this secret. You know, she just knew that there was something that was unspoken. She didn't know what it was. Because, of course, Megan's life has not been what you might call normal. we've moved frequently because that was my only way to maintain the secret.
What, thinking in case people got too close, you'd better move away?
Well, yes. I mean, I have found it very difficult to maintain the secret once I get close to people.
Yeah.
So, you know, so there always came a point where I either had to tell or move. And it was too scary to tell, so I moved.
But did you end up ever having any kind of professional help to talk about the experience you've been through?
Yes, I frequently sought, well, when I say frequently, probably half a dozen times over the decades, I did seek professional help. But they weren't able to really engage with this. And now I understand why, you know, that there is no... There's no research. There's no help for...
Well, there's no focus, is it? You focus on the family of the person who's been killed.
Mm.
What brings this to mind, Kelly, is that recently there's been a case of a footballer who wiped out members of a family in a crash.
Yeah.
There's been quite a various incidents. Lord Ahmed, you know.
Yeah.
And the press... In addition, when it's somebody in a public place, not only do they have their own guilt, it's invited from all quarters because of the press. Can you even begin to understand that added stress?
Well, there are some drivers who have contacted me who are in that high-profile category, so I understand it from their descriptions of their experience.
And what sort of things do they... They must be fearful that everybody knows, whereas you had that secret. Theirs is almost that everybody knows.
Yes. And of course, everybody knows, but they only know... a very small aspect of it.
And the tabloid version.
Yes. And the true experience of the driver is largely unknown. And that's one of the things that I'm hoping to change by speaking out.
But what do they say in general? What it does to them? Does it make them want to run away and hide from the whole world?
Yeah, it's a very frightening experience. Everything about who you are has changed. All your points of reference change. You don't know who you are anymore. You don't know what your place in society is anymore. Mm. And to have that added threat of public condemnation is terribly, terribly frightening.
Do you think in some cases it would almost make it easier if you, for instance, for you, if you had a prison sentence, right, I'm being punished, would that have made it easier in any way?
At the time I thought it would have, but now that I've, now that I know something of what the experience is like in prison through other people who have been convicted and sentenced, it's no solution.
So you still have all of those feelings and prison on top?
Yes. And in fact, I was speaking with several prison officers who I was doing some presentations with at schools on this on this question. And they say that for them, the people that they are most concerned about in prison are drivers who are there for dangerous driving convictions, because invariably those people have had absolutely no connection with the criminal system whatsoever.
Yeah.
They're deeply traumatized from their experiences, and then they have the added trauma of meeting a way of life that is completely alien to them.
But do you think it's the reason we don't ever discuss their side of things, if you like, is because it's far more convenient to paint the driver as the baddie or the villain?
It is more convenient, and yet at the same time, there is what took me by surprise when the book was published is also how much compassion there is. I've also been contacted by the families of the victims, who are deeply concerned about the welfare of the drivers.
So we're not talking about people who drunk drivers continuously and what have you. We're talking about that person in the wrong place at the wrong time who makes one error and death is caused.
Yes. But I mean, it's even the repeat drunken driver, for instance. I have spoken again with certainly one incident there where a man who was drunk at the time and who did have repeated convictions for speeding and drinking, and on one of those occasions when somebody died. I mean, he's absolutely devastated and distraught by it.
Yeah.
So even so-called, you know, habitual lawbreakers, this is a devastating experience.
Because you often get the family saying the person's only got a, I don't know, 2-year or 6-month sentence, but we, the family, having lost somebody, have a life sentence.
Yeah.
So you're saying actually... It's very rare that the person who's caused the death doesn't also get a life sentence.
Yes, And the family of the driver also get a life sentence.
Mm.
You know, many families break up over this. Many parents don't know how to help. You know, as in my case, I mean, another mother contacted me whose 19-year-old son caused a death, and she said, you know, I listen to him sobbing in bed at night, and I don't know what to do.
I remember in Australia, actually, meeting a lady whose 17-year-old son had his P-plates, took the car out and backed over his 2-year-old baby sister. And I'll never forget talking to this mother about it, trying to keep her 17-year-old alive, trying not to be angry with him and mourning her 2-year-old while her husband couldn't cope and had left. And it was just... You think, how do you come back from hell like that?
Yeah.
You know, so many lives decimated.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, this is it we read about car accidents every day, you know, that there are. I mean, in Britain on average, there are 10 road fatalities every day. And yet we even if we know that statistic, we don't know the details behind it.
No.
And you know, we see these wonderful, glamorous advertisements for cars and you know, and it's a status symbol to have a car and what have you. But really, it ought to come with a health warning.
Do you drive?
No, I don't now.
So you stopped driving from that moment?
Yes. I tried to start again when Megan was a baby. Just because it is so convenient to be able to drive, but I couldn't do it. I would have panic attacks. I'd vomit. I've now accepted that's the price I pay.
But what about being a passenger? Are you still anxious?
Strangely, I don't have any concerns being a passenger.
So you're not a backseat driver saying, no. Careful, careful, careful.
No, I'm very, on the whole, I think most people are very good and conscientious drivers.
Hmm. But Megan drives, does she?
Sorry?
Megan drives as
Yes, Megan does drive. She's a very good driver. And I was very supportive and encouraging that she should get her licence.
You know, the Department of Transport has a think campaign and that TV ad... the driver haunted by the child everywhere. Would you say, looking at that, that is how it is?
It is, but with one difference. Many people that I speak to, it's more the absence of the person who died that haunts them rather than the presence, if you can understand the difference. What that advert is depicting is that the person is always present, the child is always present.
Yes, and lying in the corner of the room, looking in the mirror, yes.
But what's present always is the fact that child is absent, that child is no longer in the world because of something that the driver did. You know, in my instance, Margaret is no longer in the world because of what I did.
But not that we put value one lot of values on one life and another. Do you think it must be even harder if it is a child? Because there's that future that's been wiped out that you would be carrying around with you.
Difficult to say. I mean, a life is a life. And I saw Margaret run for her life.
Oh, gosh.
Yes. You know, she wasn't ready to give it up, even though she was an older woman. And I think perhaps that's what I've learnt from this, is that every life is valuable. Every life is precious and sacred.
And you're saying now you actually talk about this, you talk to schools, you talk about what? That not to be so cavalier behind the steering wheel? Because we all believe, like you did when you were 17, it's never going to happen to us.
Mm. Yes, I talk about that. I basically just tell my story, you know, about how excited I was to get my driving license, and as you say, this feeling, this belief that that it would never happen to me. But it did, and it happens every day. Just I tell them that just since I got my license when I was 17 until today, nearly 40 years later, there are 70,000 pedestrians that have died just in the UK. Yeah. Now that's 70,000 drivers that have had to go home to their parents, their friends, their family, their loved one, and say, I killed somebody today.
But if you surf the internet, there's lots of help out there for the families of people whose relatives were killed in accidents, but it's pretty hard to find anything directed at drivers. Is there any help out there for people in the same situation as you were?
None.
Not at all?
None. No. No.
So nothing, I guess you could go to your GP.
Sorry, say again?
I guess you could go to your GP and ask about counselling and hopefully not be put on a waiting list.
You could. The experience of people that come to me now who are still in this stage of early trauma with it, generally they get offered tranquilizers.
So don't talk about it again.
Yeah. Sometimes they're offered counselling, but counsellors... And the other thing I do is I talk to counsellors and psychotherapists and clinical psychologists and so on, and invariably they are of the assumption that this fits into a post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, there's never been any research done to establish whether that's correct. My own view is that it's not correct.
No, it might be a part of it, but it's not the whole of it by any means.
Most of PTSD is where you are the victim of a trauma. In this case, you are the perpetrator of a trauma. You've caused a trauma, which is a completely different kind of trauma. And it's not researched, it's not understood. And the other aspect to why I believe there is so little available research on this is that, of course, to properly engage with people who have had this experience means properly engaging with death. And we're very reluctant to do that.
No, yeah, we're very scared, as we saw all around the Jade Goody death. The people who screamed the loudest, you could just tell it was a sign that society is terrified of talking about death.
Yeah. So, you know, we either have a very over-sentimentalized view of it, or we just don't want to go there.
We don't want to know about it. But if there could be help out there, if you could design something, what would it be?
Well, the first step is obviously there's got to be something in the justice system, and there is a form of justice called restorative justice, which I think is a very good option for this.
So that's when the family of the victim meets up with the person who caused the accident, am I right?
Yes, the person and the so that would be the driver and the driver's family would meet with the family of the victim.
Do you think that would help?
Yes, I do, enormously.
In what way?
I think for everybody to have to express to each other how they've been affected by it would bring back the humanity of the situation. It would allow the driver to know something of who the person was that died, the way that person is being grieved. It would allow the family of the deceased to meet the driver, to know how the driver is also grieving, and the effect on the family, and together they would come to an agreement about what now needs to happen to restore justice.
So not necessarily done in a courthouse where there are lawyers involved and what have you, but actually where there are people who are, you know, are supportive of you.
Well, the restorative justice facilitators sometimes are lawyers, and the courts can can take the option to rather than go through a formal legal proceedings. This can be part of the proceedings.
Okay.
And if the two sides can't come to agreement, then it goes, you know, to a formal hearing. And where there is gross criminality, then of course that would go straight to the courts.
And I'm also guessing, because you talk to psychotherapists and counsellors, the other thing you'd like to see maybe is them engaging with people in your situation rather than you having to do the reverse.
Yes. And I'm very blunt with people from the therapeutic community. They've got to overcome their fear of death.
Yeah.
You know, that's really what this is based on. And of course it's people in my situation who can bring some light is a strange word to use, but perhaps some...
And they can learn from you.
Yes, the people that have caused the death have a different relationship with death than most of us do.
Yeah.
And that's an understanding that society needs to take on, I believe.
But you sound very serene now, Kelly. Have you found some kind of peace now?
I have, and it's a strange thing to say, but I now value this experience very, very highly.
Do you believe it was not ordained or meant? I don't know if you have any faith or if you felt God deserted you that day. You know, when you hit poor Margaret, I mean, do you have any sense of faith or it was meant to be?
It's dangerous ground, this.
Yes.
there is a clear, I mean, when I look back on the events from, you know, when I woke up that morning until an hour later when the accident happened, it's as though every second of that hour was orchestrated to ensure that Margaret and I met in that point in time. And even from Margaret's point of view, she would normally have been inside the church. This crosswalk was out immediately outside of Margaret's church.
Right.
And she normally would have been inside the church. Something caused her to leave. Nobody knows what it was.
Gosh.
And she was walking away from the church, you know. So she left the service. She left the mass, and was walking away. Why she did that, I say, is a complete mystery. And this is a common theme in other drivers that I talk to. When we trace back the hour before the collision occurred, it is invariably as though they were guided to that point. Now, I'm not going to speculate on why and the wherefores of that, just simply to acknowledge that that's what happens.
It could have, if you had been successful in dying, and as you thought then, meeting up with Margaret on the other side, if there is another side, that's another discussion. But you wouldn't have been able to do what you've done all these years.
Yes, and that was one of the great gifts of writing the book is actually taking that long look back, you know, over a 30, 40 year period, and seeing all of the links and where everything fits together and what has come out of. Situations and experiences that seemed completely abhorrent, and yet they have their gifts, they have their purpose.
Yes.
It's like the grit in the oyster
in the
shell.
Pearl. Yes,
you know, it's a cliche, but it's also it's a fact. some of the worst experiences of our lives can offer us the greatest gift.
Kelly, I thank you so much, because I'm aware that going back over that ground and taking you back may open wounds, or you may have learnt how to deal with it, but I don't take it lightly.
Thank you.
Kelly, thank you so much. I want to tell people about the book, because I'm sure many people like myself have felt very moved. And it's given us a lot of cause for thought. Kelly Connor's book is called To Cause a Death. As I said at the beginning, it starts back in 1971 when she was just 17. And Kelly was driving off to work and just happened in a blink of an eye. This lady... elderly lady Margaret stepped onto the crosswalk, the pedestrian crossing. Kelly hit her, and her life from then, I mean, she didn't, as you heard in that interview, she didn't want to live. And she spent her whole life being told that she shouldn't talk about it, which almost caused her death. But she has turned that around. She's working with counsellors to work with other people in similar situations. And her book is called To Cause a Death. It's out now. It's published by Clearview. And of course, we should say that doesn't take anything away from the people. If you've lost a loved one in a traffic accident, your anger, your pain is absolutely understandable. And, you know, and our hearts go out to you. I guess where our heart hasn't been up until Kelly's talked about this is what happens when you just take your eye off the road for a nanosecond and invite hell into your life. You're listening to Talk to Tricia here on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool.
Talk to Tricia on City Talk 105.9.
Listen, and log on to the voice of Liverpool. City Talk 105.9.